the power of prayer. Why is prayer important? Because it's part of the process of our spiritual development that goes really hand in hand with Bible study. And we're going to come to that shortly in terms of how prayer and Bible study, I think, go side by side for the development of our characters. Now, the first reference that we're going to look at this morning is taken from Psalm 55. And so what we might do then is take a dramatic reading from this psalm. And we're going to read together verses 1 to 19 as an introduction to our remarks. So we might read around that in the group, shall we?
Yeah.
Yes, that's a good idea. Okay, all right. Well, let's take one verse each and see how we go. So could I ask you to start, please?
Sure. Give ear to my prayer, O God, and hide not thyself from my supplication.
Attend to me and hear me. I am restless in my complaint and moan noisily.
Because of the voice of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked, for they cast iniquity upon me, and in wrath they hate me.
My heart is severely pained within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me.
Fearfulness and trembling are come upon me, and horror hath overwhelmed me.
And I said, Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then would I fly away and be at rest.
Lo, then would I wander far off, and remain in the wilderness.
I would hasten my escape from the windy storm and the tempest.
Destroy, O Lord, and divide their tongues, for I have seen violence and strife in the city.
Day and night they go about it upon the walls thereof. Iniquity also and mischief are in the midst of it.
Destruction is in its midst. Oppression and deceit do not depart from its streets.
For it was not an enemy that reproached me, then I would have borne it. Neither was it he that hated me that did magnify himself against me, then I would have hid myself from him.
But it was thou, a man mine equal, my guide, and mine acquaintance.
We took sweet counsel together, mocked unto the house of God in company.
Let death seize upon them, and let them go down quick into hell, for wickedness is in their dwellings and among them.
As for me, I will call upon God, and the Lord shall save me.
Evening and morning and at noon I will pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice.
He had delivered my soul in peace from the battle that was against me, for there was many with me.
God shall hear and afflict them, even he that abideth of old.
Excellent reading. So now the one verse we actually wanted in that psalm, but you can see how it builds up to this particular verse, is verse 17. Because there it says, evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. So here is David's comment upon prayer, and particularly probably prayer when he was in time of deep trouble and distress. But there's a principle here, I think, that emerges from this particular psalm and this particular verse, and that's this, that we need to develop prayer as a spiritual habit in daily life, with a focus on what was clearly a threefold prayer of the faithful. And so David says here, evening and morning and at noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he shall hear my voice. Now, by the way, why does it say evening, morning and noon in that order? Because the day started with the evening and not the morning. I think we've done this before, haven't we? Why did the Jewish day start with the evening? Because of Genesis chapter 1, the evening and the morning were the first day. So for us, the same principle, though, will be observed, won't it, if we have morning, noon, and evening. They will be the same three prayers as far as we're concerned. A prayer in the morning, and a prayer at noon, and a prayer at evening will constitute the same idea for the purposes of our lives and our spiritual development as three prayers during the day. Now, you see the other reference there. We might just come and have a look at that one, because that's a really excellent cross-reference in Daniel chapter 6. Daniel 6, of course, is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. But what we're going to read about is the circumstances that brought him to that particular problem. You'll remember in Daniel 6 that it says, perhaps reading from verse 4, then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find none occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him. He must have had a marvellous character, mustn't he, Daniel, to be so perfect in this way, that nobody could find fault in everything that he did. And so the men said, "We shall not find any occasion against this Daniel, except we find it against him concerning the law of his God." In other words, they said the only thing we'll ever be able to trap Daniel on is something related to his worship of God and the matters of the truth. And so the presidents and princes assembled together in verse 6, and they said, "King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes and the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute." That was a lie, wasn't it? Because the verse starts by saying all the presidents, but Daniel was the chief president, and they hadn't consulted him on the matter at all. They'd gone behind his back. This was a trick, a trap, a snare. And of course we know the story, that King Darius agreed to this and therefore signed the decree, which was that no man should ask a petition of any god or man, verse 7, for 30 days, save of thee, O king. So now we come to verse 10. "Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day, there's the phrase, 3 times a day, and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime." You see what the verse says? This is not something Daniel did deliberately, was it, in defiance of the decree? Why did Daniel do what he did, even though he knew the decree had been written? The verse tells us. Why did he go and pray in this way? Was he openly breaking the decree deliberately? Yes? Yes, he knew that God would protect him, and he wasn't really doing this to deliberately break the decree, was he? Why was he doing it? The verse tells us, it's right at the end of the verse, he was only doing what he'd done aforetime. He's only doing it because it was a habit in his life. This is a habit that Daniel had built into his life. You see what we've said here? We've got to develop prayer as a spiritual habit. People say, well, how can we make prayer powerful? Simple, really, you've got to do it. That's all. Easy is easy, just got to do it. Actually, it still is quite hard, really. But the key here is that prayer will become powerful if we make it a habit. So the habit ought to be 3 prayers a day. That's what faithful people did of old. That's what David did, and that's what Daniel did. By the way, why does the verse say that he prayed towards Jerusalem? Sort of sounds a bit like the Muslims praying towards Mecca, doesn't it? Why did Daniel pray towards Jerusalem? Can you think of any scriptural reason for that? They're in captivity, yes. Yes, he was looking unto Jerusalem, but the question is, why was he praying towards Jerusalem? Just say that again, it sounds pretty good. Could he have been facing the temple? Was the temple in existence at this time? Didn't Nebuchadnezzar destroy the temple? So he was facing Jerusalem. By the way, I've sort of made it a bit tough for you, because I think he was facing the temple even though it wasn't there. You're absolutely right. I think he was facing the place where the temple was. Now the question is, why was Daniel facing towards where the temple was when he prayed? Anyone know? Well, let me give you a good cross reference for that. I think he did that because Solomon said that they ought to do that. Because if you come back to the first of Kings chapter 8, now this is the chapter where Solomon dedicates the temple when it's first built. And just have a look at what he says in the first of Kings chapter 8 and perhaps verse 29. This is what Solomon said at the time of the dedication of the temple. And what he said there was this. Perhaps verse 28 for connection. He said, "Yet have thou respect unto the prayer of thy servant and to his supplication, O Yahweh my God, to hearken unto the cry and to the prayer which thy servant prayeth before thee today, that thine eyes may be open toward this house." That thine eyes may be open toward this house night and day, even towards the place of which thou hast said, "My name shall be there," that thou mayest hearken unto the prayer which thy servant shall make toward this place. And hearken thou to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel when they shall pray toward this place. And hear thou in heaven thy dwelling place, and when thou hearest, forgive. And I think that's why Daniel was praying towards Jerusalem. Because Solomon said when he built the temple, wherever the Jews are, whatever circumstance they are, if they pray towards this place, then, O God, wilt thou hear their prayer. So I think that's what Daniel was doing. He was fulfilling what Solomon had said in the first of Kings, chapter 8, verses 29 to 31 or 32. So what's the idea here then? The idea is that the best way to help make prayer powerful in our lives is to develop it as a habit. Now I'm going to come back to those three prayers in a moment, and we're going to talk about those in a bit more detail. But what we need to remember in this regard is that what prayer does is completes the cycle of communication with the Father. Through the Word, He speaks with us, and through prayer, we speak with Him. Now just imagine what it's like can you ever imagine what it would be like if a child never spoke to their parents? Imagine a little child who's perfectly good. They always do everything that their parent asks, but they never say a word. Or if they do, they say virtually nothing. So how did you get on at school today, son? All right. How did that exam go? All right. Was the teacher interesting today? Yes. In the end, that becomes very frustrating from a parent's point of view. They would actually like to get a little bit more than that in terms of communication with a child. Imagine a child that just never talks, never says how they feel, never says anything to mum and dad. Mum and dad in the end will get terribly frustrated because parents love to talk to their children. And they don't just want a child that's obedient but never speaks. They want a child that talks, that pours out their feelings and their desires and their worries and their triumphs and their tragedies. Parents want to share in all of that. Believe me, they do. So if we study the Word and never pray, we're like silent children as far as God's concerned. We never talk to Him. God says, I want to hear what you think. I want to hear what you feel. That's what prayer is for, so that we can talk to God and communicate. In the Word, God talks to us, but if we never return that conversation, it's as if He's got a whole lot of silent children that never speak. And that's not what the Father wants. The Father wants communication between us. So He speaks to us in the Word, and we speak back to the Father in prayer. So really the two things go hand in hand, don't they, in terms of our spiritual development. What else have we got here? So what's the proper order of prayer? Well, the proper order of prayer is always God first, then ourselves. Remember what we said right at the start? The key is God manifestation. God supreme, not man. Now, you know how the Lord's Prayer starts? So let's start it. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth. So who's first in this prayer? God first, absolutely first. And then and only then comes man. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, even as we forgive them that trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And then what happens to the prayer then? It goes back to God, doesn't it? For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. So how does the Lord's Prayer start and finish? It starts with God, comes to ourselves, and goes back to God again. And that order of God first, man second, I believe, was taken from the Ten Commandments. Do you know what the first four commandments are all about? God. And the last six commandments are all about man. And that's the order of the Ten Commandments. God first in the first four, and then man in the last six. And that's the order, always should be, in everything. That's what God manifestation is all about, is that God comes first and not us. And only when we've got that right can we pray to God acceptably in a way that He might then hear us and help us in and through our prayers. Now, this is another good thing. I think there are five key aspects to prayer, and we need to learn all of these because they're all different parts of good prayers. So there's the giving of praise, and we might call that adoration. There's the seeking of help, which really is petition. There's the acknowledging of sin, which is confession. There's the showing of care and thoughtfulness for others, which is intercession. And lastly, and I'm going to change this last word, by the way, there's the offering of thanks, which on a later overhead I've changed and used the word appreciation for that. The offering of thanks, or the giving of thanks, is appreciation. Now, I think that these are the five key aspects of prayer. And by the way, you'll find all of those hidden in the Lord's Prayer. All five of those things are hidden in the Lord's Prayer. And I think all good prayers in the end will involve these ideas. Now, not every prayer will involve all of these things, will they? I don't think this is saying that we've got to have all five things in every single prayer, because there are different prayers for different reasons, aren't there? Just talk about this one for a moment, because this is slightly more unusual. This is about caring for others. But can you think of anyone that you know of who's in trouble that needs help? And have you ever prayed for them? This is partly what intercessory prayer is, prayer for other people. You know, there's something terrific about developing the idea of intercessory prayers, praying for other people, praying for your friends that are in need, praying for your friends in the truth that are in need, praying for other people that you're talking to about the truth. You know, I think there's a magic thing happens when we learn to pray for other people. Guess what happens to our own problems, do you think, when we start praying for other people?
They seem minuscule.
Oh, I do like that expression. Absolutely correct. Our own problems somehow shrink, don't they, into their proper smallness, okay, once we start praying for others. Because it's a funny thing, but it's to do with our attitude. When you're really worried about others and concerned about others, somehow your own problems don't seem quite so big as they once were. The worst thing you can do if you want to make your problems big is to think about yourself all the time. Poor me, woe is me, oh, the terrible things that come upon me. That's how you make your problems loom large. Prayer for others helps to actually shrink all of those things down to their proper size. And the funny thing is that people that pray for others and care about others and think about others a lot, funnily enough, they often say, oh, I've got no problems at all. They truly feel as if they have no problems. And one of the reasons for that is, can you think of anybody in life that you know who has a problem worse than you? Or a difficulty? Or a tragedy worse than you? And the answer is, most of us can think of someone who's worse off than us in some way or another. And how thankful we are that A, was not us, and B, how caring we should be for them. And somehow when you pray for others and think of their problems, you think, boy, I've got no problems. I haven't really got any problems at all. Not really compared to other people. So I think that's you know, a really big part of prayer is learning the spirit of intercession for others. However, what we're going to do for the rest of the session is I'm going to take you through those three prayers for the day. The morning prayer, the noon prayer, and the evening prayer, because I think they're all different. You see, I think that we need to be careful that all our prayers don't become the same. For example, we don't want the morning prayer saying, well, thanks for breakfast, and the noon prayer, thanks for lunch, and the evening prayer, thanks for tea, and that's the sum total of our prayers. I think each of these prayers, the three main prayers of the day, I think are all a little bit different, and so that's what we're going to look at right now. So let's start with the morning. Now, interestingly enough, The three Hebrew words used in Psalm 55 for the word morning and the word noon and the word evening, all three words have got to do with the sun. They're all related to the sun. Now, it's pretty obvious what they'll be. So what do you think the word for morning will be in terms of the sun doing something? What will the sun be doing for the word for morning? It's just when it's just coming up over the horizon, just rising over the horizon. What do you think the word for noon is in the Hebrew? When the sun has reached its... Now, what's the word we use? Zenith. Excellent word. It's reached its zenith. It's right at the top. And what do you think the word for evening in the Hebrew is? Just sinking over the far horizon, and that pinky glow spreads across the clouds, and the hills turn purple, and it's sunset, and the dusk starts to fall, and the day has finished. That's the Hebrew word. So all three words relate to the movement of the sun. So what's the word for morning in Hebrew? Anyone know? If I said to you, Shalom Boker Tov, which is, by the way, what you would say to anyone in Israel during the day, Shalom, peace, Boker, that's the word for morning, here it is here. Boker is the Hebrew word for morning, and Tov is the Hebrew word for good. So Shalom Boker Tov is peace, and harmony, and good day to you. And that's the common greeting All the way through Israel, if you go there, that's what people say to each other, apart from on the Sabbath. And then they say Shabbat Shalom, which is a different greeting for the Sabbath day. So the word bokeh here is a word that means the break of day, i.e. the rising of the sun. Now, what we've tried to do here is to give three scriptures to show what morning is associated with in the Bible, and here's three ideas. Now, we probably haven't got time to look all these up, so I'm just going to tell you roughly what they are. Psalm 30, verse 5. Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll read these out for you each time, and you'll see, hopefully, that the point of the quotation. So this is what Psalm 30, verse 5 says. It says, "For his anger endureth but a moment, in his favour is life. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy..." Can anyone finish the quotation off? "Cometh in the morning." Joy cometh in the morning. So therefore Psalm 30 verse 5 tells us that the morning is associated with the comfort of God's favour restored to us. Whatever weeping we've had in the night, joy comes in the morning because we experience the favour of God. Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 4, which is, by the way, the third servant song, which I'm doing in the main classes with the adults. Isaiah 50 and verse 4 says, "Morning by morning he wakeneth mine ear to hear as the learned. Morning by morning he wakeneth mine ear. So for the servant of God, morning is associated with that time where divine principles are refreshed within him. Every morning he heard the instruction. By the way, I think that Isaiah 50 verse 4 was a special prophecy about the fact that Almighty God would teach his son. I think that Christ disappeared off into the mountains in the early morning, and he'd hear the voice of his father speaking in his ear. He'd actually hear that voice. Imagine that. He'd actually hear God speaking to him. "Morning by morning he wakeneth mine ear." But there's a principle here, and the principle is the gladness of divine principles being refreshed in us as we start each day. Now, Lamentations chapter 3 is a beautiful passage, and I'll just read that section to you. It says this in Lamentations chapter 3. It's always one of those tricky ones to find, isn't it? Because it's actually sandwiched in between Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Lamentations 3 verse 22 says, "It is of Yahweh's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness." His compassions fail not, they are new every morning, is the promise of Lamentations. So the promise is the blessing of mercy renewed every morning of our lives. So what's the morning all about then, if we put all that together? Well, I think that this is what it's about. Morning represents the joy of a fresh start and the energy of a new beginning before God in the commencement of another day. In the quietude and stillness of the morning lies the opportunity to renew our endeavour before God. The great requirement of the morning is for preparation. And therefore, the main focus of the morning prayer should be on, now remember those five key things, should be on petition. So what was petition? Let's just go back to that for a moment, shall we? See at the bottom here. So petition is the seeking of help. Because the morning prayer is the time when we're going to ask God for help and for guidance and for direction in all the things that are going to happen that day. We're going to ask him to help us that we might be faithful to the truth, that we might resist temptation, that we might be true and honest, that we might move away from those things that are worldly, that we might keep separate, that we might maintain our purity of thought, that we might keep loving him, that we might have strength to overcome temptation. We're going to ask for help and all of those things. And I think that's what the morning prayer is especially about, don't you think? Isn't that really what the morning prayer is about? Is seeking God's help as the day starts. There's something nice about the morning, don't you think? Once you've got woken up, finally. I know some of us have a struggle to wake up in the morning, but once we really are truly awake, it's a special time, isn't it? The world's fresh and clean and still and quiet, and we think, oh, let's start a new day. And now we've got the special prayer with God that's asking for help. I think that's the special principle of the morning prayer, is petition, asking for help, starting again, a fresh start, a new beginning. Whatever happened yesterday, have you ever had a day that you think worked out really bad? They call them biorhythmic lows, don't they? Sometimes you get to the end of the day and you're actually quite thankful that that day has finished. And you go to bed and you think, man, that was a bad, bad day. But there's always tomorrow. And tomorrow is the fresh start of a new day. So I think that's what the morning prayer is about. Now that's a lot more than giving thanks for breakfast, isn't it? It's about thinking about the day and saying, now what do I have to do today? What do I have to face? And what do I need God's help with so that I might work through today as a faithful servant as best as I can? And I think that it's really good to try and develop that prayer so that it becomes the special prayer of the day for asking God's help. So I'll just leave that for a minute in terms of anything else you want to get down, because I don't think we're going to take copies of these. So, any questions on that particular prayer? Any questions or comments at all on the morning prayer? Excellent. Actually, I don't know if it is excellent, but I'll assume that it's excellent, that there are no questions. Okay, I'm about to move off. And let's go to the next prayer, which is the noonday prayer. So what do we know about noonday? Well, let's come back to our Hebrew word first of all. So what's the word for noonday? Well, in the Hebrew the word is sohar, T-S-O-H-A-R, and the word actually means bright light, so bright that it's actually called double light. And why is it called double light? Because this is when the sun has reached its zenith. That's the meaning of the Hebrew word, when the sun has reached its zenith. The morning was simply when it was peeping up over the horizon. Now the sun has come up and up and up and up and up and up till it's right at the very top in the middle of the sky, and it's reached its zenith. And it's so bright and so strong and so dazzling that it's like double light. So what do you think the principle then of that idea is, of the strong light of the noon? Do you know that no Jew would travel at noonday? They never travelled in the noonday sun because it was just too strong and too hot. It was a time for resting, for disappearing under shadows, if you could. Which, by the way, tells us how determined Saul was, because, you know, in the Acts of the Apostles, when Saul was travelling on the road to Damascus so that he might apprehend the believers and throw them into prison, it says he was travelling, and a bright light appeared at the time of the noonday sun, which is interesting, actually, because imagine how bright that light must have been, that it made even the noonday sun seem pale by comparison. And that was the brightness of Christ himself confronting the apostle. But you see how determined Paul must have been. Noonday, everyone else was off the roads, apart from this one man determinedly trudging towards Damascus, because he was so obsessed with the idea of capturing the believers. And Christ appeared to him, didn't he, on that dramatic road to Damascus in that confrontation. So what does noon stand for? Well, let's have a look at our three quotations. Noon stands in Scripture for the following ideas. The anxiety of life increased, the 2nd of Samuel 4 verse 5. The pressure of trial intensified, James 1 verse 11. And the feeling of strength depleted. Now, by the way, what does C-A-N stand for? C-A-N 1 verse 7. You know what C-A-N stands for? Song of Solomon. How do you know that? Mere proof. Or mere assertion. Could you give me proof of that? You are right, by the way, 100% right. But what is C-A-N short for? Does anyone know? Because sometimes you'll see this in your marginal references, won't you? It's a word, it's an abbreviated form of an old English word called canticles. C-A-N-T-I-C-L-E-S. Canticles. And a canticle was a song, a spiritual song. And so why is Song of Solomon called Canticles? Well, because it's a song. It's a song of Solomon. That's what the word canticles means. Simply means a spiritual song. And this was the Song of Solomon. So sometimes in your margin, if you ever see C-A-N, well, that's always a reference to Song of Solomon. Now, do you know what happens in the 2nd of Samuel 4, verse 5? A man called Ishbosheth was lying on his bed, says the record, at the heat of the day, at noon. and two men came and murdered him on his bed. Okay? But the point of the verse is that noon is described as the heat of the day when the sun is at its zenith and when life is becoming difficult. James 1 verse 11 says, the sun is no sooner risen with burning heat. And it talks about the flowers withering because the sun has arisen with burning heat. Canticles chapter 1 verse 7 says that the flocks would rest at noonday because they were so exhausted, their strength was depleted. So what do you think noonday symbolizes? Well, I think that what do you think it symbolizes? What do you think? What's the overall idea of the noonday sun? Yes?
Exhausted.
The time of the day when you're exhausted and the pressures are on. The pressure's on. That would be a good way of describing it, wouldn't it? The pressure's on and you're feeling the heat. Quite a good symbolism, really, isn't it, when you think about it? So let's just think about that then. So noon represents the heat and burden of life as the intensity of daily trial and daily care reach their zenith. So what happens is this. We have our morning prayer. We eat our breakfast. I don't know what it's like in your house. Actually, in my house, it's normally fairly rushed. People actually eat their breakfast and rush because they're always late to work or late to school or something. And before you know it, whoosh, they're off out the door and the day has begun and there's exams and assignments and things to rush around and do and the day's begun. And before you know it, it's 12 o'clock and the heat of the day is upon us. And the sun has arisen with burning heat. And somehow in the middle of all that, divine principles go whoosh out the window. It just sort of happens, doesn't it? We didn't mean to forget about the truth, but you just do because the sun's up. So I think that the sun is a marvellous symbol here of the pressures of life that come upon us. Every day, life gets so busy. And by the middle of the day, well, who knows what we've forgotten about what we prayed about that morning. So what do you reckon the noonday prayer should focus on? Well, I think that what we're being told here is that amidst the bustle and activity of the day, divine principles can so easily recede or be forgotten. So the great need at noon is for elevation. What was the great need at the morning? For preparation. The great need at noon, I think, is for elevation, to lift our spirits up again in the things of the truth. And therefore, the main emphasis of the noonday prayer shouldn't be on petition. We've already done that in the morning prayer. But I think what we need to do is to simply give thanks to God, to remember everything he has done for us, to lift up our spirits again, and that's really a prayer of appreciation. So at noonday, I think what we try and do is remember all the things that God has blessed us with and try and be thankful for them, just to get our spirits back on an even keel as far as the truth is concerned. Now again, of course, what we're saying is that's a lot more than simply giving thanks for lunch. It's saying thank you for my friends, thanks for the truth, thanks for our families, thanks for the ecclesia, thanks for Bible schools, thanks for all the precious things that we appreciate in the truth. And somehow, you know, when you do that, it's a funny thing, but if we give thanks to God for all the things that we appreciate, well, I think you feel better. I think you feel better. And that's just a good way to get our minds back on the truth and back in the thinking of the truth, when the heat and the burden of the day has sort of burned it all out of us. Because life is like that, isn't it? It's like that for all of us. By the way, don't think that it stops when you leave school. It gets worse. The heat of the noonday sun gets worse. I think as we go through life, you'll find that the sun, for some strange reason, gets hotter and hotter every day of our lives. And we need the noonday prayer so that we just, as it were, stop for a moment, step aside and say, yeah, I just want to have a wee think about things here and just remember what God has done to lift my spirits again so that I'm elevated in the thinking of the truth. Okay. So now the evening prayer. Well, now the evening prayer is going to be something different again because, well, what does evening stand for? Let's look at our Hebrew word. The word for evening is as follows. It's actually the word ereb or erev, which means to grow dusky, but but it particularly relates to the setting of the sun. So now the sun has lost its heat, it's simply that golden orange ball on the edge of the hills as it sinks slowly over the horizon and disappears. All the fierce heat has gone out of the sun. It's not dazzling bright anymore. It's not burning us up with its heat. It's sinking over the horizon, and dusk is coming upon the face of the earth. And there's that sense that everything is beginning to come to an end for the day. It's the end of the day, isn't it? So Erev, the setting of the sun. So just as Boker is the rising of the sun and Sohar is the zenith of the sun, so now Erev is the setting of the sun. So what do you think evening is associated with in Scripture? Well, I've got these quotations that I think are interesting in that regard. The first one, Ecclesiastes chapter 11 says, in the morning sow thy seed, and until the evening withhold not thine hand. So the sower goes out to sow, and he sows all day from morning to evening, but finally he withholds his hand when the evening comes, because here is the satisfaction of endeavor completed. The work of the day, the work of the endeavors of the day has come to an end. And I think that's very similar to the next one, which is Psalm 104 and verse 23, which has something very similar to say. And this is what the psalmist says about the notion of evening. He says in verse 23, man goeth forth unto his work and to his labor until the evening. Man goes forth to his work and to his labor until the evening. So therefore evening is associated with the fulfillment of labor that has now finally come to an end for the day. And the last one, which is very interesting and no one's turned up, which is good, let me see if you can guess what it is. A man went into a field at evening time. And this man who went into a field at evening time went to meditate, and he prayed while he meditated. And does anyone know who it was? Now, it wasn't Abraham. Let me give you another clue. Now, imagine this. When he opened his eyes, now it wasn't Joseph, when he opened his eyes, his bride, which is very interesting and no one's turned up, which is good, let me see if you can guess what it is. A man went into a field at evening time. And this man who went into a field at evening time went to meditate, and he prayed while he meditated. And does anyone know who it was? Now, it wasn't Abraham. Let me give you another clue. Now, imagine this. When he opened his eyes, now it wasn't Joseph, when he opened his eyes, his bride stood in front of him. And his name was Isaac. That's absolutely correct. It says that he went out into a field to meditate or to pray at eventide, says Genesis 24, verse 63. And by the time he'd finished his prayer and opened his eyes, the bride that he would marry was standing in front of him. So that was a pretty remarkable end to a prayer, wasn't it? But the point of the verse is that that's the time to pray and to meditate. That's when Isaac went out into the field to do that. So what's the idea then, you think, of evening time? Well, I think the idea is this, that evening represents the tranquil calm of rest after effort. It's all over. The day's finished. Can't do any more. Whatever you did or you didn't do, it's all finished now. The labour's over for the day. If you did a good job, terrific. If you did a bad job, too bad, but you can't do any more because evening's come. It's all finished. The day is over. The labours are ended. And now we have a period of calm as the sun sets and darkness falls. So what do you think that the evening prayer would focus on mainly? Well, not petition. We're not asking for God's help for a new day. That was the morning prayer. We're probably not focusing on appreciation in terms of the giving of thanks. We've done that at noonday to lift our spirits. But I think that the main focus of the evening prayer is... Yes. Because with the completion of endeavor and the cessation of labor comes the opportunity for contemplation and meditation upon the events of the day. The great opportunity of the evening is for reflection, and therefore the main thought of the evening prayer should be on confession. Because now, you see, we review the day and we think, actually this hasn't been quite as good as I would have liked. There's a few things I haven't done very well here. In fact, there's a few things where I've made mistakes and where I've failed and where I've sinned. And the more you meditate upon the events of the day, the more you think, I have fallen short of the glory of God. I have not lived up to the measure of Christ or to the standard of his example. And so the evening prayer is going to be especially the time for confession. All those other things are right, by the way, because I think that every prayer should have praise to God in it. So adoration, I'd say, yep, give you a tick for that. Intercession for others, yes, that might be a good time, but thinking on a personal level, that'll be certainly the time when we confess sin, isn't it, at night time, as we go to our beds, and you review the events of the day. We'll say, okay, this is the time for confession, as we think about what we've done and what we haven't done, and we'll want to come to the Father. Now, of course, there's a problem with this, isn't there? Can you confess sin and ask for the Father's forgiveness of sin before you're baptized? I think you can probably confess sin, but can we ask for the forgiveness of sins before we're baptized? Can you personally ask for the forgiveness of your sins? And whatever you think, could you give me an answer from Scripture? Shall we set that for homework? What an excellent idea. So the question for today then is, can we confess sins and ask forgiveness for them before we're baptized? If yes, why and how? If no, why not? And can you give some scriptural quotations to support your argument? But that's not going to stop us developing prayer as a power in our life even before we're baptized, because we're certainly going to need it afterwards, and it's not going to suddenly come miraculously when you get baptized. Sometimes I think people think, oh, I'll be baptized and all will be, my life will be changed. No, it won't be. It won't be any more changed than it was before, unless you're developing sound habits in your life. It won't change miraculously. In fact, one of the worst things that happens after you're baptized is you realize you're actually the same person that you were before you're baptized. You're changed in terms of your official status or status in the sight of God, but as a basic person, unfortunately, you find you're the same person with all the same troubles you had before you went into the waters of baptism. And if you haven't got habits like study and prayer, well, you're still going to struggle to develop those after baptism. But the crucial thing here is, can we seek the forgiveness of our sins before we're baptized? We might be able to confess them, but can we ask directly for the forgiveness of them? Well, I'm going to surprise you all by closing early today, because that's the end of that session. So I think what we'll do is turn the tape off, and then we can have questions or comments from the fourth floor, and you can feel free to say whatever you would like.